Welcome back to this podcast by Young China Watchers. We're a global network of young professionals interested in China. My name is Sam Colomby. My guest for this episode is Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, former National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. General McMaster recently published a book called Battlegrounds on key foreign policy challenges for current and future U.S. administrations. The general now holds fellowships with Stanford University and the Hoover Institution and joins this podcast to speak about his vision for a new approach to U.S.-China relations.
I wanted to start by asking you, your China chapters start with your trip in 2017, your trip to China. So I wanted to ask you, how did that play into your existing views on China? Did that change your views on China at all, or how did that inform you further?
Well, Sam, the trip came after we had already framed a new strategy, a new approach to really the policies of the Chinese Communist Party. And it was a policy that rejected assumptions that underpinned previous policies that by 2017 were demonstrably false. And foremost among those was this assumption that China, having been welcomed into the international order, would play by the rules, as it prospered, would liberalize its economy, and then ultimately liberalize its form of governance. And it was clear that under Xi Jinping, the opposite was happening. So we had already fashioned a dramatic shift in policy. So that trip in November of 2017, it confirmed quite a bit for me. And of course, for me, that was my first trip to China. So I spent most of my career overseas and in Europe and in the Middle East and in South Asia. So it was an education for me. But it did confirm, I think, this fundamental shift in policy that we put in place.
You also, I think one of the points that you bring up during your description of that trip is your perception of some sort of insecurity. I think you draw a parallel while you're walking through the Forbidden City, a parallel with the old dynasties and their insecurity. You see that in the current administration as well, in the current leadership. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So one of the approaches we took to really our strategies broadly and our new foreign policy was to really try to infuse them with what the historian Zachary Schroer calls strategic empathy. And in particular, to try to understand better, not just the interests, but also the emotions and the ideology that drive and constrain the other. And from my reading of Chinese history and from this tour of the Forbidden City, what I saw was fear of losing control. And what evoked that observation for me was the architectural style of the old city, and I write about that in Battlegrounds, and how the party is driven mainly by fear of chaos. It's combined with ambition, but I really do think that fear of chaos is really the main emotional impetus behind the party's actions internally and to a large degree externally as well.
We had Tim Clissold on, the author and current, I think you would call him, negotiator almost. We had him on the show last or 2 months ago, and he is a very clear proponent of engagement and continued engagement. And one of the claims that they make, him and people alike, are that it's one of the only ways in which we can attempt to change China's internal policies, Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong. So the question is that wishful thinking? Has engagement failed?
Well, I guess, Sam, what I'd say is, how's that working out? Right. I mean, how's that working out for the people in Xinjiang? Maybe we should ask them. How's that working out in Hong Kong? Maybe we should ask them. So I just think, you know, engagement in and of itself with the party has not worked. Hey, I mean, I am for engagement with the Chinese people. I am for engagement with Chinese businesses that are not directly under the control of the party or operate against the interests of the free world. But of course, as you know, that space is dwindling because of the Communist Party's effort to extend and tighten its exclusive grip on power. So what I'm for, you know, what I'm trying to lay out a program for essentially in Battlegrounds is competition and a recognition that competition doesn't have to lead to confrontation. In fact, engagement and cooperation, I think, had put us on a path to confrontation because the party had been emboldened by its perception of its growing strength, emboldened by a sense that it had just a fleeting window of opportunity to, in Xi Jinping's words, take center stage in the world. And I think perception and Western weaknesses. And I write about in Battlegrounds how 2008, I think, is a turning point in connection with the financial crisis. And this is when you begin to see, I think, the party not only extend and tighten its grip on power internally, but take a much more aggressive approach to exporting its authoritarian and mercantilist model.
Yeah, you make several claims about China aiming to export its model. What in your experience has led you to conclude that?
Well, I mean, how about just take just one case in point? There are many others. How about Zimbabwe? Zimbabwe is a perfect example of the Chinese model, right? It is a way, it is an example of how One Belt, One Road and investments in a country have created a servile relationship with a corrupt regime. And then how China has also exported its technological know-how to create a surveillance police state that is effective at stifling any degree of human freedom within that country. How about Cambodia, you know, as an example as well? So I think what you have is the promotion of this model with other authoritarian, corrupt regimes, but then also you have the effort to use this mercantilist model combined with a form of economic aggression. This is the so-called debt trap set for many countries under the One Belt, One Road system. These are massive loans to companies well beyond what those countries can service, and debts incurred for projects that aren't going to get a return on investment or don't get a return on investment. This was the case in Sri Lanka, for example, where they built, you know, the Chinese companies built this vast port that has really no commercial rationale to exist. But it's a port that will be under the control of China, the influence of China, and can be used by the PLA. I mean, let's use a Western Hemisphere example, Ecuador. Ecuador has a multi-billion dollar dam project that as soon as it's finished has hairline fractures in it. The turbines are clogged with silt. The first time it turns on, it blows out the country's electrical grid. But it indebts the country to the extent that all of Ecuador's oil imports are given to China at an artificially low price to try to mark them up. And so it creates, I kind of, what some authors have said in developing economies, a new type of colonialism.
Now, one of the, what many observers say when we're talking about debt diplomacy is that we sort of deny these countries their agency, right? Sri Lanka was perfectly capable of making that decision for themselves. So was Ecuador. So were these countries victims of China? Did they make the wrong decisions? And how can we blame them for those decisions when there was no viable alternative for infrastructure investment?
Well, there were corrupt authoritarian leaders in both places. And as you know, in both places, those leaders were ousted in large measure based on the degree to which these corrupt deals were seen by the people as not in their interests. There's been a bit of a reversal of that in some countries in terms of parties making a comeback. For example, the party that had always been in power in Malaysia voted out after the 1MDB scandal, and China actually played a very important role in solving a big cash flow problem so that, you know, the corrupt officials there could continue to steal billions of dollars from their own people. So heck yes, I think you can blame these governments for their own corrupt actions. And this is why, you know, in Battlegrounds, I talk about really we have to be a bit introspective, you know, in terms of how we compete effectively. And one way to do it is to try to turn what the party views as weaknesses into strengths. For example, I think investigative journalism is probably one of the most important tools to apply against the Chinese Communist Party strategy. A strategy I describe as co-option, deals that look too good to be true, and guess what? They are too good to be true. and then coercion, because once you're in, you're subjected to the coercion of the party. And then concealment. What China tries to do is they just conceal this as normal business practices. But these are anything but normal business practices. These are practices that cut against the interests of the people. And so to your question, hey, we should have standards. We should have standards of transparency and accountability. And I think this is what you've seen Japan take a lead on, and other countries join with Japan on establishing international standards for infrastructure investment in particular.
But it's hard to put standards when there's no competition, right? If let's say Sri Lanka and Ecuador, if their only option for infrastructure investment is China, and in many African countries that is the case, what would standards change if there is no other alternative? Yeah. So how can the U.S. compete in these fields?
Well, the U.S. does compete in these fields. Japan competes in these fields. The IMF and the World Bank compete in these fields. And the data shows that if it's a Chinese-funded infrastructure project, I forget what the percentage is, but I think it's between 80 and 90% of the workers are Chinese. If it's an IMF-funded project, the vast majority of the workers are local, right? And those wages and everything go back into the local economy. So I think the standards can play a very important role in terms of really the people then being able to hold their governments accountable, just so they don't sign bad deals, so they don't sign away their fiscal and economic futures. And so I think this is making some progress now.
You talk of strategic narcissism, and I just want to explore that a little bit. So can you talk to us about your analogy with the Icarus story and sort of the U.S. history with China in that perspective?
Well, the Icarus story is one of hubris, right? One of being overconfident. And I think that we were overconfident. When I say we, I mean the free world. I mean the U.S. and Europe in particular, Japan and others, because we had this belief, I think, that at the end of the Cold War, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, that the arc of history had guaranteed the primacy of our free and open societies over closed authoritarian systems. And I think that over-optimism led to complacency, right? So we believed also that great power competition was a relic of the past. We also believed that in advanced militaries, our technological military prowess would make a future war fast, cheap, and efficient. And I think all of this was a setup, right? We were flying too high, right? And it was a setup for disappointments in the 2000s. Disappointments associated with the recognition that non-state actors, jihadist terrorists, for example, can bypass our tremendous military strengths and commit mass murder on American soil of nearly 3,000 innocent people using box cutters and airplanes. A recognition that wars like those in Afghanistan and later Iraq aren't going to be quick and efficient and easy. In fact, war still requires the consolidation of military gains to get the sustainable political outcomes. And it's immensely important to pay attention to what drives violence, the fear, honor, and interest that Thucydides identified 2,500 years ago. And so the financial crisis followed. And then I think, we began to fly too low after that. We now underestimate in large measure the degree of influence we can have. And we are, I think, leaning toward strategies more of retrenchment or resignation, right? So I think what we need is something in between that. We need sensible and sustained engagement with the world. And that's what the case I lay out in Battlegrounds.
So how do you define that sensible and sustained engagement? What are the boundaries in which Icarus can fly?
Well, the boundaries begin, as I try to in the book, to understand how the recent past at least produced the present as the first step of making a projection into the future. And so I think, first of all, it's understanding the challenges to our future on their own terms, and oftentimes from the perspective of the other, right? Adversaries and enemies and rivals. This is this argument that I borrow from the historian Zachary Shore of strategic empathy. And then you're in a position, I think, to be able to craft objectives and maybe overarching goals. But the most important step, I think, that we've skipped oftentimes is to identify the assumptions. What are the assumptions on which I'm going to base a policy or a strategy? And in particular, what are the limits of influence? What are the limits of agency? What are the limits on my authorship over the future? Because others get a say, right? This foreign policy is interactive, and the future course of events is going to be nonlinear. So I think what I try to offer in the book is a way to think about these complex challenges and a way to craft more sensible policies and strategies.
I'd like to prod a little more and just ask you some of the decisions that were made during your tenure that followed on from this concept of strategic narcissism, the concept of competition over engagement. Because, for instance, we've seen the trade war, obviously. Would you define that more as confrontation than competition?
No, I think it's within the scope of the United States and other countries to demand fair and reciprocal trade, right? So if you're going to use trade enforcement mechanisms like tariffs, for example, those ought to be aimed at eventually leveling the playing field such that Chinese national champions, their state-owned enterprises, don't have these unfair advantages that allow them to transform the global economy in a way that disadvantage our workers and our industries. Because producing these goods at artificially low prices and dumping them on our markets drives people out of business, right? Now, some economists would say, hey, what damage is that doing, right? Because really, our consumers are just consuming cheaper products. That helps everybody. But it has affected transitions in our economy that left large portions of our societies behind, right? And this is a source of frustration in the United States. You see that, in the so-called Rust Belt, many of those economies are recovering now, but they were left behind, by the transition of the global economy in the 1990s. And then especially after China's entry to the World Trade Organization in 2001, under the assumption, of course, that China would play by the rules, which it did not. And so I think not playing by the rules, as I mentioned, in connection with state support for state-owned enterprises and so-called private companies, but also didn't play by the rules in connection with non-tariff barriers to entry to the Chinese market and to use the lure of entry to the market to force the transfer of sensitive technologies and intellectual property in a way that gave China an unfair differential advantage. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of grievances, right, that all of us should have about how the party has conducted itself. And a way to confront that kind of form of economic aggression, I would say, is with trade enforcement mechanisms. Now, I'll tell you, Sam, I mean, I think that that's been imperfectly implemented. I mean, I don't see how steel and aluminum tariffs on our allies, help you get to Chinese overcapacity and overproduction and transshipment and dumping, for example, right? But I think the fundamental approach is right to use trade enforcement mechanisms as part of a much broader strategy. I mean, I think what you see, Sam, is a real holistic approach to the problem set associated with Chinese Communist Party economic aggression.
So you're talking about reciprocal access as being the ideal one of the ideal outcomes. But as you mentioned earlier, with the insecurity of the current Chinese government, reciprocal access would be seen as a sort of an existential threat to the existing system. So is there a way to get to reciprocal access without confrontation? Because you claim that there is a way to compete without spiraling into confrontation. What is that way?
I mean, the party would have to, the party leadership would have to conclude that they can have what they want, right? That they can, realize a better future for the Chinese people without suppressing their own population and without promoting, a foreign policy and an economic policy that advances their interests at our expense, at the free world's expense, right? And I think China should be able to have enough. But under the ideology of the party, I don't see it happening unless costs are imposed on the party for not playing by the rules. And I think it's time to do that. It's time for the United States, Europe, Japan in particular, those three, working together. It's going to be hard for China to say no. Now, what China's trying to do, though, is race, right? Race to take advantage of this fleeting window of opportunity. The new contested space now is on data standards, for example. China wants to be the country that sets the data standards for the world. And I think if we let the Chinese Communist Party do that, a party and a regime that uses that data for population control purposes, for example, that would be a huge mistake, right? So I think that really, for in the United States, whoever gets sworn into the presidency on January 20th next year, I think that president ought to put at the top of the agenda international cooperation on the problem associated with the Chinese Communist Party's policies. This is not a China-U.S. problem. This is not a mean Donald Trump making Xi Jinping, act the way he's acting. This is a free world China problem. And I think more and more leaders and especially citizens around the world are coming to that conclusion.
Then just to conclude our conversation, I like to ask for our audience, if they would like to learn more about this topic, where would you direct them? What do you read on a daily basis to stay on top of this issue?
Hey, I think there are just some tremendous scholars in the U.S. these days who I've really relied heavily on. Elizabeth Economy is one of my colleagues at Hoover. She's wonderful, and her book, The Third Revolution, I think is a landmark book in terms of recognizing the shifts that Xi Jinping has put it into place. I highly recommend John Pomfret's book, the Beautiful Country and the Middle Kingdom. John Garneau's work in Australia, I think, was groundbreaking in a lot of ways on Chinese influence. I read Bill Bishop's Cynicism. I could go on with others who I just admire tremendously, who are much more knowledgeable about China than I am. I am a neophyte on China, right? But I'm hoping that I can be part of the discussion that can lead to a more sensible approach to this, you know, the aggressive stance of the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, pretending to speak for the China watching community, I'd like to thank you for your contribution to the discussion. I think it's a very valid input, and thank you so much for coming on our podcast today.
Thanks, Sam, and you stay well and stay safe as well. What a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure.
That was Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, author of Battlegrounds, which is now available through HarperCollins. Thank you to General McMaster for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more about our organization, go to youngchinawatchers.com to find out about upcoming events, read interviews with China experts, or replay one of our webinars. My name is Sam Colomby. This episode was edited by Joshua Cartwright. The music is by Blue Dot Sessions.